KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. Today is Thursday, May 2nd. I am your host, Adam Gardner. Here with me is Leah Murray, my former professor at Weber State University.
Adam, it is so wonderful to be on KSL at Night with you. This is going to be a blast.
The pleasure is mine. It is exciting. You know what? We have a great lineup today. And our first segment is really exciting. We've talked a lot on KSL at Night about the convention and whether those that thought it was crazy and a disaster and took too long, or those that were like, this is the...
Wait, because we have not talked together since the convention. Did you go?
I was there.
17 hours?
Yeah, I didn't quite make it 17 hours, but I was there. If somebody didn't let me butt in line to check in and credential, I would have been there for 17 hours. So I spent about an hour and 45 minutes before I could credential and get my access key code to vote on my phone.
Yeah.
But some people were waiting 2 and 3 hours to do that. That's never happened before. So it was kind of crazy. I would talk to people in line. Is this your first time? I've been going to these for 20 years. I've just been a nerd for a very long time had a lot of friends. But these folks in line.
But you made all new friends. I made all new friends. 4 hours in line.
and these folks are just, no, this is my first time. What's your experience so far? I've been here for 2 hours and I still haven't even checked in. What am I in for?
Do you think they'll ever come back?
That's really hard to say. Everyone's so different, but I'll be honest with you. At the end of the day, I came home and my legs were shot.
Yeah.
And it was a long, emotional day. Tempers were running high, especially since I was involved with some of the campaigns and I like that atmosphere. That makes it fun for me, helping folks. And so I don't just sit there and watch everything happen. I like to be with different candidates that I like.
Right.
And so it got really heated. It was a long day. And I'm like, I don't even know if I'll be back. And I love this stuff. I'll be back.
You'll be back.
It's in my nature. But I say every year, oh, I'm not doing this again. This is too much. But we'll be back. I mean, they literally got kicked out of the Salt Palace at midnight.
So pause. Did anything not finish?
Well, I don't know because I wasn't there at midnight.
You didn't stay.
I did not stay and see it through. So I'm a diehard unless it interrupts my bedtime.
Got it.
So I'm gonna go home.
I love that.
One of the biggest topics of the day, we kind of got a glimpse of him on the stage, was Phil Lyman selecting his new lieutenant governor candidate, Lane Bangeter. And so I didn't know who this guy was. It's been kind of fun to see new people pop up on the stage and get to do my own research and Google him, find out who he was. But there's been a bit of a controversy with the Phil Lyman campaign. And just in kind of full disclosure, we tried to get him, Representative Phil Lyman, on this show. We have not heard back from him. So we're going to talk about him anyway. He was on Dave and Debbie earlier today. And so we kind of have a few sound bites.
Before we do that, can I read something to you
as
your former professor? But I feel like it's a document probably you've read. Article 7 of the Utah Constitution, which talks about the executive department. And I'm not going to read all of it, but Section 3 for qualifications for officers says, no person is eligible to any of the offices provided for in Section 1 unless at the time of election that person is a qualified voter and has been a resident citizen of the state for 5 years. Next preceding the election. So I just kind of want to say that, Adam.
It's great context.
What does resident citizen mean to you when you hear those words?
It means you live in the state of Utah.
And what does 5 years next preceding the election?
You take the next election and you have been there for the 5 preceding years.
So
it's not an accumulative time of living in Utah.
It's not like I camped in Moab for enough time over the years to have 5 years. So the answer is the next election is 24. So I minus 5. Math is hard sometimes for people. And that gets me back to 2019. So the human would have to be here, since 2019, living in the state.
Well, and it takes me back to, I worked for Senator Mitt Romney. And, people called him a carpetbagger on the campaign trail all the time, which means you were in another state and then you moved purely for political purposes to another state to win an election. But he moved here in 2013 and he took office in 2019.
Right.
That's not the type of argument we're having here.
By the way, that was 6 years for the.
That was six years. Right. And it was also governed by the United States Constitution that sets those requirements. This is the state constitution. And so it's pretty clear you got to live here for 5 years. So, Leah, you're right. That's helpful context for what we're going to be talking about. I want to play you want to play clip four?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Let's play. Is that okay to start there? Is that all right?
Yeah. This is a great place to start because I want to make sure we have time for this. So let's play clip four.
After your win at convention, shortly after you made a selection for lieutenant governor, and then there was a question of whether or not that lieutenant governor candidate is even eligible. Where are we at right now? The question was, does your candidate have enough? I guess, consecutive years living in Utah to qualify?
Well, I mean, the Constitution says that they have to live in the state of Utah for 5 years. And that's what, so Lane's lived in Utah for 30 years. And then the contest comes up, says, oh, no, that means immediately preceding. Well, that's not what the Constitution says. It's not what the lieutenant governor's application documents say. And here's the thing. We weren't even allowed to file an application. We weren't even allowed to file the paperwork. And when we went in on the deadline, they wouldn't even read my lieutenant governor candidate, the constitutional requirements. Because if they did, then he would be able to check the box and say that they did that. So they were obstructing the whole process. And the law says that candidate is allowed to file the application. And then if there are challenges to that, then they can make the challenges. But we weren't even allowed to file the application.
Yeah, so I feel like having read the Constitution like we did, and that's why I wanted to go right to this clip, Adam, I think he's wrong, right? Doesn't the Constitution of Utah clearly state resident citizen 5 years preceding, right? That is not any 5 years. It is absolutely clear as crystal.
Leah, you're spot on. Phil Lyman makes an interesting point here, though, where he says kind of that doesn't really matter because my lieutenant governor candidate went in to go file and has declared himself as following the rules. So the lieutenant governor's office is now bound by saying, okay, well, we're not going to like independently verify this. We will accept it and read the requirements to you and we're good to go. And the lieutenant governor's office is saying no. And if you remember, because there's a big conflict of interest when you're the lieutenant governor, Deidre Henderson, you are part of the Cox Henderson team and you're running the elections and you now have to regulate your opponent. There's a big conflict of interest that happens. But that's always happened. Happened with Spencer Cox when he's lieutenant governor. So it's happening here. So an independent verifier to deal with this race, a former state senator and former lieutenant governor Greg Bell actually issued an opinion on this. The lieutenant governor accepted that opinion and said, sorry, we know that you haven't lived in the state of
Utah. I love what you just put there. So thank you so much. I don't think I knew this part of it. So it's not just that the elections office said no. They said, we can't say no, conflict of interest. We will bring in Greg Bell to read the Constitution to you and confirm this. And they did that.
So he authored an opinion and it is up on the state's website. You can read and see what he said. But they said, we're not going to accept even the application from Phil Lyman's lieutenant governor candidate, Lane Bangeter. We're going to get into this and so much more here on KSL at Night. We have a great show for you. We're really excited about our next guest. We're going to be speaking with United States Congresswoman Celeste Molloy. Stay tuned.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend, Adam Gardner. Adam, let's keep talking about politics because I feel like that's what we do best and we should do it more. As KSL News Radio has reported, incumbent congressional representative for District 2, so that's House District 2 in Utah, Celeste Molloy, did not win the GOP nomination at convention. And I a little bit am surprised by that. Like, I think she's a wonderful congresswoman.
Yeah, she's great.
Right? So, and I will tell listeners, I'm not in CD2, so I am in no way, I can't
Me
vote
either.
For her.
Like, Me
so I'm
either.
Just saying, I think she's wonderful. She did not win the GOP nomination, but given the way Republicans do their convention, she had enough votes to force a primary, right?
That's right. To win convention outright, you have to get 60% or more of the delegate vote, and your opponent can't have gathered signatures. So, neither one, Celeste or Colby, running, they didn't get signatures. So it was 57 to 43. So Celeste is still in it and is a strong candidate in the primary election. It'll be June 25th.
All right. So last night, KSL and I had a conversation with Colby Jenkins, who won at convention. And tonight we want to make sure that we give equal opportunity to all of our candidates. So we are having on incumbent Celeste Molloy. Welcome to the show, Congresswoman.
Hi, it's good to talk to you guys again.
Yeah, no. So talk to us about, I loved what you said. So I was not at the convention, but I was reading later. And I think you said you didn't gather signatures because you trusted the delegates, right? So you said, you know, yeah. I trust you. I want you to trust me. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, how that convention went, how you were feeling about it?
Yeah, I was feeling really good about convention until 2 days before when my senior senator decided to jump in and endorse my opponent. I've been working hard with the delegates. The delegates put me here. Like you said, I never even signed up to gather signatures. I'm the only one in the race who didn't. And I felt good about trusting the delegates who trusted me. But then when Senator Lee decided to jump into the race, that was a game changer. So we went into hyperdrive. I called as many delegates as I could, which I had already been doing. And I thought I would be okay getting to 40%, and I was. But that was political drama that I did not expect and did not need, frankly.
So that's a little bit of an unprecedented move. I'm reminded when I worked for Senator Romney, Senator Lee was upset because he didn't get the endorsement of Senator Romney. He was the only one of his colleagues that he didn't endorse in the primary at all. And he said it was, you know, tradition that you endorse your colleague. But in this race, that didn't happen. Why do you think that is?
No, I don't know for sure. I've always been friendly with Senator Lee. Mike and I have talked on the phone several times since I've been in office. He didn't call me before he decided to endorse.
Wow.
We did have a lot of conversations about the FISA bill. We actually want the same result on FISA. We both agreed that it needed to be amended. In the end, he would have rather seen the bill fail because he didn't get all of the amendments he wanted. I wanted the bill to pass because I wanted to get some of the penalties and the accountability in there. And it seems like he just couldn't handle me not doing what he told me to do.
Which is really interesting. You know, I'm looking at when you won your election. You had been in office for, and candidly, I was there when you got sworn in and gave your first speech on the House floor. And it was like a tear-jerking moment because normally every member of the House gets sworn in at the same time. And it was just you. You got sworn in. And I remember on the House floor, you were saying the FFA creed. And everyone was kind of like tearing up as you were giving this speech. And it was such a cool experience. And then a week later, your opponent filed to run. And so I thought that was very interesting that he didn't challenge you while you were running, but he decided to do it when you'd been in office for about a week.
Yeah, and he formed an exploratory committee before I even got sworn in. Mm-hmm. So now there's a lot of messaging going on, and that happens in a campaign.
Sure.
But the messaging is all about my votes and how I'm not conservative enough. But the truth is he decided to run before I even got this job. So it's not really about how I'm voting because I hadn't cast any votes at that point.
Congresswoman, I'm wondering if we could just talk for a moment. We've been talking since Saturday about that convention, the 17-hour Republican convention on Saturday. And a little bit people have criticized it for its lack of decorum. So our lieutenant governor, Representative Kira Berkland, I'm wondering, I'm wondering how you felt. Like, were you reading that same kind of mood in that room? Like, did it just feel like, what did Lieutenant Governor Henderson said? She said it was no longer family friendly. And I'm wondering if you were feeling like, is there a way to do this better? You know, that to have conventions, not have all that kind of drama. But also, did you feel that drama in the first place? Was that the same mood you were feeling?
Yeah, I stood there and talked to delegates for most of the day until the main voting started. And I felt like people were pretty friendly. They were frustrated that it was taking so long to get credentialed. But, you know, it's really easy to criticize party leadership. It's hard to run one of these events. And I'm in a funny position when it comes to this because, you know, convention was not the way I expected it to go. It ended up being a different kind of experience than I had thought it would be a week earlier. But also, I wouldn't be in office without the convention system. So,
why do you say that, Celeste?
I could not have run in a special election that was a straight primary. I didn't have the cash. I didn't have the name recognition. And those are the two things that usually determine a winner. But 8 months ago, 10 months ago, I got to appeal directly to 900 people. And I called almost all of them. And I told them my story and told them why I wanted to run. And I was able to win over a lot of delegates. And I couldn't have done the same sort of effort in a primary system. I mean, I could have put in just as much effort, but it wouldn't have been enough in a primary system. I'd have had to have a big war chest and a high name ID.
Oh, I appreciate that. All right. So tell me. Okay. So let's move on. Right. So we're in the primary now. You've got like, what's the plan? Right. So how, you know, just tell us how you're going to pull, like, what's going on? Do you full overdrive for the next month and a half until that primary? What does that look like? How are you campaigning? And do you think that primary goes differently for you than the convention did?
Yeah, I think the primary goes differently. And my team knew all along that I might be going into a primary. Getting to 60 a convention isn't easy for anybody. And so we've got some commercials already made. We had, you know, ad space already bought. We knew there was a good chance we'd need this. So we're ready to go. And we're just going to stick with our plan. Part of what made me a good candidate last time around is that I didn't get rattled and I stuck with my plan. So I'm going to do that again this time. It is unnerving to have a 14-year senator suddenly come out swinging at you, but it doesn't really change what I'm going to do. I'm still me. My goals are still the same. I'm going to provide the best representation I can for the people of the 2nd District. I'm going to make the best decisions I can on behalf of the people of the 2nd District. I'm going to be out and about. They're going to see me everywhere. That was always the plan. I'm going to be doing things like this, going on the radio, talking about what I'm doing, making sure people are hearing from me. That was always the plan. So it turns out what I planned on doing anyway and what I'm going to have to do now are the same thing.
Well, God, I think that's great. I also have got to wonder, you have to run a really, really hard and expensive race coming up in June 25th, but you also have to keep your day job. You are a representative.
Yeah, that's right. She's got to keep working. That's right.
In the U.S. House. What are some things you're working on?
Well,
we have
I'm
about
talking
a minute.
To you right now.
Yeah.
From Minnesota. I am in Minnesota for a natural resources congressional field hearing on wolves. These are the kind of things people in Utah care about. They care about how the federal government is managing our resources. And I'm going to keep working on those things. I'm going to campaign when I need to campaign, but I'm also going to work every single day to protect Utah's interests.
Congresswoman Celeste Malloy, Congressional District 2, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, guys.
Next up on KSL at Night, Adam, let's pivot and have a conversation with a Utah state legislator about some interesting things happening at a middle school and a local school district. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. We are your hosts, Adam Gardner here with Leah Murray. You know, Leah, if you've heard about these bomb threats that are going on in the Nebo School District at Nebo Middle School.
There was one today. Am I right about that?
There was one today. And you know what? I want to encourage our listeners. If you text breaking to 57500, you're going to get all the breaking news, including when there's the latest bomb threat at Nebo School District, or no matter what's happening around the state or our country, you can text breaking to 57500 to stay up to date on everything everything that's happening. Along that same topic here, Leah, have you heard about what's happening in some of these school districts over the furries, this kind of new phenomenon?
No, I feel like I knew what a furry was from like a CSI episode at some point, right? Like that's about all I know. And maybe I don't want to know, Adam.
Well, we have a real advantage during this segment because we have Senator Mike McKell from Spanish Fork on with us right now. There's been a lot happening in his district, and he's here to kind of give us context of what's happening at Nebo Middle School. Senator McKell, thanks so much for being on the show.
You know what? Thank you for having me, both of you. It's good to be here, and I am happy to give you some context. And let's just state the obvious. Distractions at school are not appropriate. Kids that wear animal headbands, that's not appropriate, and that's something that schools need to tackle, and I think schools are tackling that. But to be really clear, schools are a place for learning, and that kind of distractive behavior just should not happen. And I'm glad there's awareness to the issue, but boy, I'll tell you, it's been blown out of proportion, and now we have a serious school safety concern, and that's what concerns me today. And thank you for having me on.
You bet. Senator McKell, would you provide kind of some context of what is happening at Nebo Middle School?
Yeah, so and let's just start with what's happened today. Today was a fourth bomb threat this morning, and it's much more aggressive than that. We've actually had some death threats to some of our school administrators.
Oh, my word.
You've had some folks that have posted their personal information online. Obviously, I've taken shots at social media as a legislator, but the social media carriers were really quick to take down that personal identifying information. I've had some school administrators, law enforcement, been at their house. They've been there to check on them. They've been there in the middle of the night more than once. And it's a little bit out of hand. So we had a situation where there was a protest. There were definitely some students that were distractive at school. And again, animal headbands and masks. And again, that's inappropriate. We all know that. But what happened next is not okay. There was a protest. And right now, I think what's important is there was a private parent chat group. And a lot of these messages have gotten out. We know who's out in front of it. Let me give you some common names. We've got Eric Mustos from St. George. He's part of that private parent chat group. And you know, he's a self-proclaimed conservative from St. George. I don't know why a man from St. George is.
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah,
that
I seems was actually
really weird.
Sitting here going, I don't think it's anywhere nearby.
It is really
yeah.
weird. And in the messages, and I have the messages, he's encouraging these parents to push this national and to go out and protest. And really, he's been out there encouraging this discontent and this contention. And look, what he's doing is inappropriate. It's a school safety issue. We've had legitimate threats now. And I get that people want to be liked on social media. They want likes. They want clicks. But I'll tell you, if your method of getting likes and clicks and building your audience online is by creating contention in the Nebo School District in a middle school, I have a serious problem with that. We also have a candidate for the state school board that is part of this private group chat where these parents organized and helped organize this protest. And that's just really troubling to me, because now what we're on is we're on our fourth bomb threat. Kids showed up to school today in a middle school in Payson, Utah, with law enforcement presence. And you think about the mental health impact of having law enforcement at your middle school. I mean, these are young kids with law enforcement there. And this is a serious issue. And again, I worry about the distractions. Education is to be focused on education. But boy, we've got some folks that have taken this to a whole new level, and they're creating some serious school safety risks. And also, they, you know, in the end, the purpose is, how do I get more likes on Facebook? How do I promote my product of discontent? And we're just better than that, Adam. We are.
So, Senator McKell, can you just draw the line for me? So what we have is a private group chat of parents who sound yeah. like they are kind of professional agitators, maybe, right? Or there's some people who are trying to work people up. But then how does that lead to a bomb threat or the fourth, you know what I'm saying? Like, so what is the connection between that going on and that protest and people, I think, behaving not well at all and the bomb threats that we're having at this school?
Yeah, great, great question. So some of the idea was to take this story national, to get Glenn Beck involved. And what it did is, and what it's done is it's just stirred that just discontent, that contention. And there have been folks lashing out back at the school because of that. And a lot of the threats have been directed at school administrators because the argument is the school administrators haven't done enough. This is a new problem at the school. School administrators have been tackling it right away. And look, we all agree that type of behavior, wearing, again, animal masks, animal headbands, that's not appropriate. But we need to let schools have an opportunity to solve those issues as well. And instead of letting the school solve that issue, there are some folks that have taken advantage of the situation. Again, you've got a candidate for the state school board that's part of this private chat group, stirring people up and stirring this type of contention. And when you do that, I mean, we see how much discord we have in our nation right now. There's always bound to be some blowback. And that's what we've seen over this last week. And it's just not appropriate.
So what did the school administrators do to solve this problem? So this was happening at the school. I called another school district to say, have you guys had this problem in your districts? What's happening? Like, I don't have any kids in middle school. Right. Mine are all younger. And so they said, yeah, about once or twice a year, each school will call us and say, we have kids dressing up like animals and some are barking at other students and it's really disruptive. And so they call us and they say, hey, this is kind of weird. How do we fix this? What's our protocol? We walk them through it and they fix the issue.
Right.
What was happening at Nebo and how were administrators trying to solve the issue?
Well, and that's exactly what happened at Nebo. It was reported and the administrators immediately kind of resolved that issue. They talked to the kids. The kids stopped doing it. The problem is they stopped doing it, but the protests continued. And once the behavior was stopped, the distracted behavior at the school was stopped, the other behavior didn't stop, and it actually ramped up. There's some pretty hurtful things said about a number of school administrators. I know there's a principal, they claimed that, you know, the principal had a furry for a child. This is a principal that doesn't have kids. And just
so they're just saying,
right.
Yeah. And there were a lot of outrage, a lot of misinformation. And if something happened somewhere in the world, it now happened in this Nebo middle school, which just isn't accurate. Was there a problem? Yes. Did the administration jump in right away to resolve it? Yes. But what happened next is the problem and where it's gone today. I mean, again, we look at school safety. Schools need to be a place of learning where kids are isolated from those types of distractions. And to think about middle school kids showing up today with law enforcement presence again at the school, to me, is just really, really troubling. And I have to ask the question, you know, what is a guy from St. George accomplished by doing that? Yep. How is a guy from St. George stirring the pot in Payson, Utah? What are we accomplishing to help school safety?
I think that's a great way to leave it. Senator Mike McKell, we want to thank you for all the work you're doing on this issue and keeping us informed. We really appreciate you joining. Next on KSL, let's talk about Congress weighing in on Formula One and not letting Mario Andretti on the grid. Stay with us.
KSL at night. KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Adam Gardner, and we are talking about all the interesting things. And Adam, I don't know, you're relatively new to KSL at Night, but did you know that you could go back in time and listen to every podcast episode that I was on?
I do now.
For like 2 years. So, and listeners, you can too. You can come listen to our shows on KSLpodcast.com or really anywhere that you get your podcast. You could download it, just look up KSL at Night, search for KSL at Night, and you can listen. And I would also tell you this, Adam, like, we've talked about what we're about to talk about before. So if someone's listening to this episode and thinking, what about Formula One and how does it intersect with politics? You could probably find an earlier version of this where we've had Alex Carey, KSL Sports host, assistant program director, on the show before to talk about Formula One. Alex, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm one of those rare Americans that like find myself waking up early on weekends for no reason.
Pause.
Just to watch Formula One. So there we are.
But real quick, Alex, when they were just like in the South Pacific, like in Japan and Australia, were you up at like, you know, 1 a.m? Are you that kind of fan?
Well, yeah. So I am because I'm a late night guy anyway. That actually worked out because, one, it was a Saturday night.
Yeah.
Because of how far ahead they were. But yeah, I was up late. And I mean, it's the ones that are 6 a.m. like in Saudi Arabia. Those are the tough ones for me. Like late at night is fine. I don't like waking up early, but I've gotten into that now that I've become one of those weirdo American F1 fans. And it's weird too because I do mainstream sports talk as my job, and then like my hobby is following F1, and on the side my wife is like, you have too many sports going on.
Wait, so Alex, is that relatively new for you? This is a new phenomenon, liking F1? Or have you been a fan
new-ish. I mean, I'm one of those guys that got, when the very first season of Drive to Survive came on Netflix, which is now 7 years ago, I was hooked. I was all in. So it's been 7 years of spending way too much money to for a monthly subscription to be able to get all this stuff and to be able to watch it. But you know, Americans are coming in droves, and so this particular topic is really important because F1 could screw this up, because this is a massive amount of money that's come into the sport thanks to America getting involved and really liking it. And it's been, you know, typically, historically, it's a European sport and an Asian and Southeast Asian and now Middle Eastern sport. And so it's one of those things that if you get the U.S. involved, they will break off billions of dollars for you. We have no problem spending it on sports, but they could screw it up. They're on their way to possibly screwing it up.
All right. So let's like set the frame right here, Alex. So this weekend is the Miami Grand Prix. So none of us have to wake up too early or stay up too late to watch it. Right. And what we're talking about is, basically, Formula One said that the Andretti team, and then you get into more details or correct anything that I've said wrong, cannot join the grid, right? So there are 10 teams. The rules allow for 12 teams. Mario Andretti asked to join the grid, and Formula One said no. And I think because it's right ahead of Miami, Congress has decided, right, to get involved, and the Andrettis were up on Capitol Hill this week. What am I getting wrong? And, flesh that out for us.
No, nothing's wrong. Lee nailed it all. I think the interesting thing is that, so Mario Andretti, the reason he's an important figure in this is because he is our only recent American champion in F1. He is a world champion in F1. He won it back in, I want to say, the late 70s, maybe 78. And so American world champions in F1 are very rare, and he's one of the few, and he's, you know, a godfather of American racing. And so he threw his name in there, and also he attached it to Cadillac. So it's Andretti Cadillac, which GM and Cadillac are no slouches when it comes to throwing money at racing. They'll do it. And not only that, they'll do it well. And they are primed and ready for it. And as soon as America kind of went all in, like I said, they've had the race in Austin for a while. They added Miami, and then they added, of course, the Las Vegas Grand Prix, which I was able to attend last year with your former producer, which I think is kind of funny, too, because like, we were down there, and Carlos and I were just like, I mean, just in awe of what was going on, because people were eating it up. I mean, it's a kajillion-dollar industry, and so it's become huge in America. We have three races now here in the U.S., And the FIA, which is the governing body of motorsport in general, it would be comparable to like FIFA, right? So you have FIFA, who kind of runs all of soccer in the world, of like the sanctioned, more important, you know, leagues. And then you have the leagues that run their own thing. And F1 is just the top league of motorsport of circuit racing. So the FIA signed off on it and said, yeah, we love it. Here's the proposal. Great. It's not dead, though. The problem is that the owners and the teams in F1 are the ones who said, no, we don't want this. And they don't like the competitive. So what they're doing is they cut it off for 2026. So 2026 is when they're going to have new rules, new regulations. And they felt like, at least their explanation was, it was too soon to be able to really make an impact and to be competitive. So they want a competitive team to get in, which is funny because there are a lot of teams right now who are not competitive.
Yeah,
so
right.
That's why it's laughable, right?
Right.
So that's
exactly
why it's laughable. So they'll go, including another American team, or at least the Haas team, which is, you know, semi-American. But this is what they call a works team, you know, an OEM team. This is a manufacturer. So they have two things here. they were concerned because Cadillac hasn't developed their own engine yet. They want them to do their own engine. They don't want teams to come in and just start buying from other teams. There's a lot, which is what a lot of other teams do. You know, like Haas buys from Ferrari, Aston Martin buys from Mercedes, Williams buys from Mercedes. So you have teams who do that. So it, not to get too far into the weeds, they felt like, hey, bring your own engine to the table. And also, 2026 is too soon. Like, for example, Audi is getting in as a works team. They're going to take over the Sauber team in 2028, which is, I think, when the real window is going to open. The regulations are there, and I think they're just doing it to basically say, get your ducks in a row for your own engine manufacturer. I don't think it's total American hate because they see how much money has come in. They can't deny it. And the media rights holder for the entirety of F1 is Liberty Media, which bought the media rights, and it's an American company. So you don't want to upset the media rights holder either. And so I think ultimately it'll end up happening, but you know, it's the equivalent of trying to get start a brand new NHL team, which we're doing, of course, here, but it's already with the, you know, the pieces are already there. They don't have to worry about whether or not, you know, this is going to work because the team is already put together. The coaches are there. The GM is all there, and we can kind of just pick up where they left off. In F1, it takes a minute to develop engines. It takes a long time. These engines are $10 to $14 million per engine. So it's a lot of development. I think they just didn't want it to happen yet. And Congress is right to ask the questions. Their whole thing is antitrust, right? And so
now how does this fit into antitrust, Alex? Can you explain that?
What they're saying is, so I think what it really is, Adam, is like they're saying, hey, just give us an explanation here. Are you trying to take away the ability to be competitive in this marketplace? Like, are you taking it away because it's an American team and you just don't want Americans involved because your rules say this, but you're doing this? And so I think that Congress got involved because there are a lot of high upper, you know, people who said, hey, will you ask about protectionism
to Europeans.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's exactly right. But this is a European run sport but they certainly love to go, yeah, but your media rights holder is an American company, and that makes a big difference. I just think it's going to be one of those things that they're not going to be able to deny them forever. This is Cadillac, GM. You know, that's a huge company. They want teams like Ford involved, and Ford is going to start putting its name on engines for Red Bull in the next little while. But an actual American team, an American manufacturer in the sport will be huge. It'll be the next kind of turn the corner for Americans to really kind of get involved at the mainstream level of F1, but I think it'll just take a minute. I think Andretti Cadillac wants to get in, but I think it would be awesome if they made their own engines. I think 2026 in the F1 world, everything goes so slow. It's like, yeah, 2 or 3 years down the line, we're going to have a competitive team. It's very much like, you know, we have with our professional teams. It's like, you know, the Jazz are rebuilding right now.
Yeah.
And rebuilding, you know, showing up with a brand new team is a hard thing to think of for the sake of competitiveness. It's just kind of laughable because there are some really bad teams in F1 right now.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. But I think the thing I wanted to point out is it would be the first American-owned and first American-built team, right, Alex? So it's not Haas is American-owned, but they buy from other companies. This would be ground up. Yeah, and just 30 seconds, are they sending you to Miami? Do you get to go for KSL?
That's laughable. No. For some reason, nobody shares that same love for the sport as I do right now in the sports department.
All right, we got to work on that, Alex. Yeah. All right, Alex Carey, KSL Sports Host, Assistant Program Director. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, guys. We'll talk to you again.
Next up on KSL at Night, let's pivot and have a conversation about diplomacy and how it regards Ukraine.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. We are your hosts, Adam Gardner, and here with me is Leah Murray. You know, Leah, there is a lot going on in the world today. We've talked a little bit about Ukraine in past shows. We've talked about the conflict in Israel and Gaza. And I mean, all over the world, you have crazy things happening in Africa. You have stuff happening in Myanmar and Thailand. And it seems to me that if you look around protests on campus here in the United States, that the world is a little bit on fire.
Yeah.
And we seem to talk about like peace through strength and, you know, who's a hawk and who's an isolationist. And those are kind of the lenses that we view the world here in the United States. And so I think there's some other options that are kind of available to the American public.
Do you feel like, Adam, so again, I'm an American politics person, which you know, because you took my classes, but like, I feel like if you took international relations classes, they would talk about hard power, which maybe you were just referencing, right. But another concept is soft power, right? Which is not peace through strength, but maybe peace through, you know, handshakes, right? Like, yeah. Peace through conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have kind of an expert in the field right here in the state of Utah, Felicia Maxfield Barrett, who is the CEO of Utah Global Diplomacy. Felicia, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Hey, I want to know, Felicia, we've been talking a little bit about hard power versus soft power. First of all, kind of, can you explain to our listeners what's the difference?
Yeah. So, you know, hard power is what most people think about when it comes to diplomatic relations. It's your ambassadors, your embassies, your diplomat. It's the formal negotiations. It's the following a protocol, you know, which is absolutely critical and important to national security in our country and here in Utah. You know, but what often gets overlooked is the value of soft power. And soft power is that everyday interaction that we have here as Americans with those around the world. And it takes so many forms. I mean, it could be exchange students coming over. It could be cultural programs like dance or music or sports diplomacy. You know, for us, specifically with Utah Global Diplomacy, we host professional and cultural international exchange programs. And so what that looks like in all reality is we get these delegations from around the world. They come to Utah on these different themed programs that run anywhere from business to government to religion, journalism, teacher and education. And we match them up with people in Utah who are doing similar work so that they can just meet each other and shake hands and sit down together and explore what is working here for us in Utah and could it be a benefit to those individuals in their own countries. But the key to that is that it's that shaking of the hand. It's that putting a face to all of these big issues that we are addressing and just getting to know each other and talk to one another. So in other words, soft power is, it's the long game for the State Department.
I love that. And I was also thinking in your list, I feel like the soft power, when you were saying it's like bringing arts, but like sports, right? So I immediately was thinking the Olympics and the role that Utah has in hosting all sorts of athletes from all over the world. Are you all involved with that? And if you are, to what extent are you? And what does that look like?
Yeah, so not formally involved with the Winter Olympics, but as we are preparing as a state and a city to welcome the world once again back to Utah, you know, what we're thinking through is how do we dispel some of these stereotypes that either we have about countries from around the world or vice versa, you know, countries coming to Utah. And, you know, I remember back in when we hosted the first Olympics, the big thing was, okay, we've got to find Utah on the map. You know, we want to prepare people from around the world that they already know where Utah is on the map and they're excited to come back. And that we have a community of citizen diplomats right here in Utah that are really excited to welcome the world once again with that cultural sensitivity.
Oh, I think that's great. You know, it reminds me, I'm not a well-traveled man. Right. I have been to St. George and back. But it reminds me one time I went to China on a.
I feel like you're well traveled if you've been to China. I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to question you.
Yeah, the only place I've been to in Europe is Ukraine. And the only place I've been to in Asia is China. So it's kind of an interesting world perspective. If it's a hotbed, I want to be there. So what was really interesting is, we hear Congress talking so much about China being an adversary, and certainly the government and the CCP, they are our adversary. And we can do that in a different segment. But what was great was when I got to go to China with other congressional staffers and meet Chinese folks and just shake their hands in the town square, in shops, and talk to them. It really softens your position on the people. Like, we can't just be talking about government versus government all the time. We really have to focus that there are people that live in these countries, and a lot of times they don't agree with their leaders. And in some countries that are authoritarian, you can't actually say that.
Right.
And so what does your, how do you find these groups from other countries? How do you find these folks that want to come here?
That's an excellent observation. And, you know, so many times we hear that adversary conversation around China versus the U.S. And, you know, again, going back to that hard diplomacy or that strong diplomacy of government to government relations, where we exist is that people to people connections. And we hear it so often that people aren't always their governments. And so while sometimes
that's a great line.
Hard diplomacy will cease or it's got very strict relations, the people to people connections are always going to be there. I mean, you just go onto any social media platform and you can immediately start talking to somebody from a different country. And so it really is thinking about, well, our guiding principle is the idea is citizen diplomacy. And that's the concept that we all have the right, even the responsibility, to shape U.S. foreign relations, and we do it that one handshake at a time. So for us, our exchange programs come through the U.S. State Department. It's through the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs. You know, our flagship program is the International Visitor Leadership Program. And embassies from around the world are identifying people in their countries and their communities who get invited by our government to come here as a cohort. And they're actually in the United States for about a month. They always start in Washington, D.C., but then we're part of this larger network that belongs to an organization in D.C. called Global Ties U.S. There's about 90 of us across the United States. And so these delegations are going to different city stops because Utah's Utah. We're not Miami. We're not Seattle, right? We're Utah. And so the idea is these delegations need to have a really good, diverse understanding of what America has to offer. And so we just submit proposals in and we get selected. And then we're that host organization that sets up all of their meetings and their cultural activities and try to foster that, you know, case study scenario so that they can see what's working for us here in Utah. And then they're moving on to the next city and seeing what happens there. And then our hope is that we have such an incredible impact that when they go back to their countries, they go, you know, that was a really good idea that they were doing in Utah. How do we do our version of that program in our own country? And that's the global impact that our work has.
Felicia, this was a great segment. I really appreciate it. I didn't know anything about Utah Global Diplomacy before this conversation. I really want to thank you. That was Felicia Maxfield Barrett, CEO of Utah Global Diplomacy. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And this was KSL at Night. Stick with us. We're going to talk about a House bill on anti-Semitism coming up next.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Adam Gardner. And this is the best 2 hours of radio you possibly could be listening to.
Easily.
To know all the things you need to know. Don't you think, Adam?
Absolutely.
And I feel like if there are other things you need to know, what you want to be doing is texting breaking, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G, to 57500. Because, Adam, what happens when they do that?
They get an alert. They get all the breaking news.
That's right. So if something's happening in the world and it's not 7 to 9 p.m. and you're not listening to the best 2 hours of radio, like, you can get a text that says, northbound I-15, there's a crash. I have found it very helpful because every once in a while I need to know like where something has happened. Make sure you're texting the word breaking to 57500. All right, Adam, let's get into some politics, if that's okay.
Begrudgingly. All
right. Begrudgingly. Ready? So I feel like House Republicans are having some problems, man.
You know what? I disagree. We actually don't make any mistakes.
You do not have people who are like, let's just have a speaker fight twice in 8 months because that's for fun.
You know what? The fact that we have a speaker is a win for us, and I don't think you should take that away.
I love this. And they, well, all right. So you're wrong, but I'll let you say what you just said. But the answer basically, right, is that the House Republicans, it's unruly.
Yeah.
So they've got a one vote majority. And I'm going to tell you what, in Congress, if you're going to actually want to do anything, you needed to have a much bigger margin of error there, or you've got to have your ducks marching in the same row.
The other alternative is you can work with the other side of the aisle and you can have compromise. I learned that in my Congress class.
How warm and fuzzy. That's beautiful.
Taught by Dr. Murray at Weber State. So, you know what? I think that's really important that Speaker Mike Johnson has kind of figured a lot of that out. He went in really as a hardliner. And yeah. I think that his caucus, the majority of his caucus, right? The majority of Republicans are saying, we want to go this way. And he's seeing that, yeah, maybe that is the right way to go. And that this the Freedom Caucus, people that he actually kind of identified with, they really liked him. Maybe they're obstructing regular order. And the Democrats have the same problem, but they're not in charge. So they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to talk about it.
Right.
It is very, can I just tell listeners out there?
Yeah.
One of my mentors is Congressman Rob Bishop. And I said, what do you like being in the minority or the majority more? And he goes, the minority is way easier to be in because you just get to yell and say no to everything. Yeah. The majority
has to
governing is hard. And so I enjoy being in the minority when I don't want to have to do anything, but being in the majority is really hard to govern. And we're seeing that played out in spades in Congress right now. And so you have these different factions of the House. You have the ultra progressive Democrats, and then you have your blue dog moderate folks.
Yeah.
And then you have your more moderate conservative Republicans, and then you have your Freedom Caucus folks. And so Speaker Johnson is having to kind of juggle the needs of the entire body and the entire country with just a few members of his caucus that could derail everything that he wants to do.
So talk to us about what does that look like when Hakeem Jeffries basically says, if Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I think she's going to do it next week, brings up this motion to vacate. First of all, by the way, change the rule. Right, Adam? It has got to be the case that we've now played enough with this fun rule of only one person in the House can move to get rid of, to vacate the speaker.
Right.
I feel like we've got to have some minimum threshold. If you were thinking, what would you think would be the right number? 20, 40?
I think somewhere around 40.
Yeah, okay.
Makes a lot more sense. You got to have it. You have to build coalitions to oust somebody.
It. Oh, I love that. Right.
The Freedom Caucus has 20, 25 people in it. And so you don't want that caucus to still hold all the power. So you need them to be able to join with another clique in Congress
to actually
get something done.
So if you're going to vacate somebody, you actually have to talk to somebody who's not at your table
that
at lunch.
Doesn't just believe everything
that
you believe.
Right. Okay. So let's say, first of all, A, we got to change that rule. So I think that's got to happen. I love your answer. And maybe it's a rule that moves or something. You're like, when we count the caucuses in the House, whatever the number is has to be
Let's be honest. It's never been an issue before. So we've never had to worry about vacating the chair. This was a deal made with Speaker McCarthy and Matt Gaetz saying, I know I'm not going to like you, and now I'm going to lord that over you the entire time that you're speaker. And it took 9 votes for him to get ousted. 9.
Right.
In the entire body. So the Democrats allowed that to happen. They did not save Speaker McCarthy. They are not friends.
Right, because they hated him.
They hated him.
He had baggage. Yeah.
And the Democrats calculated that this is going to make us look like great governors, right? So we're going to let this all play out. We're all going to vote as a block for Hakeem Jeffries, and we're going to look like the ones that are ready and prepared to govern because we can make a decision. They have not taken that same step this time. What they're saying is we're going to save Mike Johnson. And then they're taking a different route, but the result is the same. It's during an election year. Everyone's really heated, and they can say, you know what? We're the ones that are prepared to govern. We're not going to oust the speaker. And it shows the public, the American public, that they're kind of pulling the strings.
Right.
That's what it's looking like.
Yeah. And also that they look bipartisan, which I think a lot of Americans kind of feel like, wouldn't it be nice if everyone actually worked together? Does that make sense? It's opposed to. Do you think that does damage to Jeffries going forward at all?
I don't think so. I think his caucus is pretty behind
him. Pretty tight and okay with it.
Yeah. I mean, and they made some pretty stringent demands. They wanted Ukraine funding. They wanted funding for Israel. They did a China bill. And
so they pretty much got everything they wanted.
And so did the Republicans. The Republicans wanted a lot of these things too. And they went along with him. These were overwhelming votes. They funded the government. They don't have a lot on him.
Right.
The Republicans, especially in the Senate, said, we're not going to handle anything with Ukraine until we get a border security bill. And all sides kind of agreed, well, fine, you're tying our hands. If we can't do anything with Ukraine, let's write a border security bill. And so you had members of House Republicans and Democrats, Senate Republicans and Democrats got together over months and months and wrote a bipartisan bill and said, here we go. And even the Border Patrol Union, mm-hmm. who does not like Democrats, does not like President Biden, said, hey, guys, this is actually pretty good.
That's the right bill.
We've never had this type of authority before. You guys should pass this. And by the way, it gives us a little more funding. And Democrats kind of called the Republicans bluff. And Republicans, led kind of by Donald Trump, said, no, don't ever pass this bill, because when I become president, I want to fix it. Don't let them fix
it. Right. Don't give a win to Biden.
Don't give a win to Biden and the Democrats. And so Republicans walked away from the table and they totally called our bluff.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of left hat in hand. And so the Republicans realized we have to start legislating. We have to get things done. We have to fund the government. Now it's incumbent upon us to do these things and kind of ignore this right wing of our caucus to govern.
So one of the things that happened today or yesterday is GOP leaders in the House. So we've been picking on them. So let's talk about something super specific. Now have a new oversight investigation plan, right? So they are going to bring in elite universities that are pro-terrorist, anti-Semite, right? So the answer is, not that the universities are, the protests, I think, is what they're talking about, right, Adam? So the answer is, what we're seeing is all sorts of people on elite universities that are pro-terrorists, anti-Semites, they're taking over these campuses. We must give, so this is a quote from Representative Michael Lawler, Republican from New York, we must give the Department of Education the tools to hold college administrators accountable for refusing to address anti-Semitism on their campus. It's interesting, a majority of Democrats joined. So that was approved.
This was not a close vote.
320 to 91. So what do you think? I mean, like, were Republicans hoping that would set up a fight and it didn't pan out for them? Or what do you think?
No, I think this goes back to something you said earlier, where the Democrats are having a really tough time on this issue and they don't want to talk about it. Republicans want to keep this in voters' minds because they see it really fracturing the Democratic caucus.
Yeah.
And this is a win. But also, a lot of the Democratic caucus agrees with this position. So they're going to vote for it because it makes sense.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how all that plans out. And stay with us, listeners, because coming up next, we're going to talk about President Biden speaking about the protests. So we'll just stay with this topic.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. We are your hosts, Adam Gardner and Leah Murray. We've been having a great show so far. And, you know, we've all been following, Leah, especially you working on a college campus. I know this has got to hit pretty close to home for you. But every time we turn on the news, every time we hop on KSL, we're seeing protests all over the country in campuses at UCLA, Harvard, most recently, we just saw the U of U, and they've, I think, handled it a lot differently than other campuses around the country.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting. I actually think Utah State had one as well. So, but I am most aware, I think, of the University of Utah. And the thing that I want to add to this, I will just say, I was like, thank goodness Weber State graduated last week, right? Because
great timing.
A little bit. I don't want to, it's contagious, right? So students see other students doing things and then they kind of get ideas. So I was like, by the time it hit Utah, we had already graduated our students. There's really not a lot of kids on campus. So I don't think we're worried about it, if that makes sense. Yeah. It's unlikely to happen. But it is hard. The U is having its graduation tonight. And I know that there are people who spent a lot of hours planning that event, you know what I mean? Making sure that all these kids get celebrated, making sure that the thousands of people who are going to be extra on campus are safe, you know, and this adds a whole extra layer to that.
I you bring up a great point, because I've seen some videos, and this is the Twitterverse, and I recognize that's kind of a bubble. But I've seen some videos where kids at Columbia are saying, we're not having our graduation. I was a high school student graduating in 2020. I didn't get a high school graduation. Now I don't get a college graduation. These guys are going to fork over hundreds of thousands of dollars for their education at an Ivy League school. And then to not be able to walk or get their diploma seems kind of unfair.
Oh my gosh, it's totally unfair. And as someone who thinks graduation is super important, right? So you probably know Weber State brought Rainn Wilson to our commencement. And the reason why you bring someone like Rainn Wilson is you're like, we are celebrating. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's fun. And this is a huge kind of collective, if you will, party. And we're all very impressed by what you've done and how hard students work. I always say April's like the twitchiest month of the year on higher ed's campuses because everyone's like, oh my gosh, it's the end of the year and we're getting graduation ready and we're all trying to graduate, and pass our final exams, right? And then you've got that's not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because of protests. USC, hadn't heard that Columbia canceled. USC had canceled. And I exactly, Adam, what you said, like the first thing I thought was, these are kids who didn't get a COVID, like they didn't have a high school graduation. Yeah. Or maybe it was on Zoom or it was one of those drive-by.
It was lame.
It was not cool. And they probably, USC is a really cool school. That's the place where the celebrities like bribe people to let their kids in. Yeah. Like it's a really fancy school. And then you've worked your tail off for 4 years and now you're not, like this whole thing is just very disruptive.
Yeah. And Leah, I want to ask you this. You mentioned it was protests that were keeping that graduation from happening. Is it protests themselves or is it something else? I feel like campuses throughout time, this is the purpose of your college years. Get it out, right? Go protest.
Yeah.
Go like hang out with your friends on the quad. We're not leaving. We want better cafeteria food. We want like apartheid to go away. Whatever you're protesting.
Yeah.
I don't care. So is it just protesting itself? Or is it something bigger that's keeping this?
I do think it's possible it's something bigger. So I love this question, Adam. I think what's happening is you're not wrong. And at Columbia specifically, like if you were going to Columbia, one of the things they're going to tell you is we have an activism attitude, right? Like, you know, I'm not sure what the words are, but they basically...
We're Ivy League, but we hate the man.
Right, a little bit. That's right. We're super elite and we hate the elite. but yeah, so they're going to be very much like our kids are going to be activists. This is what we're going to teach you to do. I think normally they would roll. But what happened this year was October 7th happens. There's a lot of, and we've talked about this on this show, there's a lot of anti-Semitic behavior on campuses as a result of October 7th. These protests are pro-Palestinian, generally. They're like Palestinian solidarity protests. And what happens is Elise Stefanik on the House Education and Workforce Committee called to the table the presidents of Ivy League schools. And she got the president of Harvard, fired. She got the president of UPenn fired. So you're Columbia, you get hauled to Congress. She's absolutely terrified, right? Yeah. I mean, anybody would be. And she's thinking, I'm going to say something wrong, right? That's going to end up
We're
in me.
We're all terrified in class. That's good to see university presidents terrified sometimes.
So she's going to be like, I'm going to go there and say something wrong. She gets totally coached to make sure that whatever Elise Stefanik asks, she answers correctly to a Stefanik. So she answers the question, and then as she's coming back from Congress to Columbia, that's when the tent encampment goes up. So she, how do I say, it's different because Congress is paying closer attention, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so I just think like, because administrators are aware that Congress is really paying attention and you could be called to the carpet at any moment for stuff that's happening on your campus, that ticks everything up a notch. And so, you know, some administrators are like, this is terrifying. We're just not going to have a graduation.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And other administrators are like, we're just going to close campus till like May 10th. Right? Like everyone just go take a break and we'll come back and start over in a desperate attempt to survive this.
We've had a couple of sound bites that we've played on this show a little bit. And one of the interesting things is, President Biden has just kind of finally weighed in. And I want to play this sound clip for you real quick.
There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. People have the right to get an education, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked.
I see nothing wrong with anything he said. I'm a conservative Republican. He said the right thing.
Right.
These protests have been going on for a long time. Why did he wait till right now to say something?
Right. Like, so the answer is, so let's be fair to President Biden, Ilhan Omar, right, who is, I might have said that wrong, Ilhan Omar, apologize, I'm getting her name wrong. So the congresswoman, her daughter was arrested at Columbia. So Democrats are very split on this issue. We, a couple of like months back on KSL at Night, did a show about two House members from New York City whose districts are right next to each other. One is very pro-Israel. One is very pro-Palestine. And the worry is that this Gaza issue is going to rip the party apart. And so I think if you're Joe Biden, you're the leader of the party that's got but that energy. Does that make sense? Yeah. You've got in your party someone whose kid has been arrested at Columbia, and in your party people who feel like anti-Semitism's gone too far. Man, it'd be really hard to comment. So you're not wrong. I feel like maybe he should have answered earlier. I understand this is a loser issue for him, no matter what he says.
Yeah. I watched the press clippings of the White House, you know, press tour. And I feel so bad. I mean, I don't feel bad for any of these people, let's be honest. But I watch her up, the White House press secretary, and every time she's asked a question, why hasn't Biden said anything? Why haven't you come out and kind of chosen a side? She always goes, I've been very clear on this. You haven't been very clear on this.
I've been very clear, muddy. Yeah.
It took President Biden to come out and actually say something, which I think is really important. Maybe it's too little, too late. You have Chuck Schumer, who is probably the highest ranking Jewish American in government right now. He's the majority leader of the Senate, a huge deal, one of the most powerful people in the country, pro-Israel, you know, and then you have Bernie Sanders, who's Jewish and seems to be very pro-Palestine, and every speech he's given is talking about Gaza. I want a blurb just popped up on my phone where Mitt Romney had an idea. I thought this was kind of funny. He said, anyone that's caught protesting, don't forgive their college loans. One, I don't disagree, but it's kind of interesting to see Republicans are using this as a way to be like, look, the Supreme Court struck down your student loan plan, and we're going to kind of go after it now, too. You can't really argue that they deserve to have their student loans forgiven, too. So great topic. Stay with us on KSL at Night.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray. And maybe my favorite thing that's ever happened is I'm co-hosting a podcast with one of my students. Adam,
great
do you
to be
remember?
Here.
Do you remember being in my classes?
So I 100% remember being in your classes. I've tried to block out a lot of what happened. No, in fact, I was relaying this story to someone earlier. A great memory that I have is I had just gotten off a 2-year mission and trying to figure out school. I got home in November and was like, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I had heard that doing an internship at the state legislature was a thing. And that really intrigued me. I had always loved politics and government. I had always loved policy. I wasn't good at any of them. But I really had like a desire to do something in politics. And so I walked up to the social science building.
That old building.
That old, awful building. And I have very distinct memories in some classes of ceiling tiles falling on
your
desks.
Head? Did they
next
fall on your
me,
head?
Never on my head, but to empty desks next to me. Thank goodness no one wanted to sit by me. You could have been very seriously injured. But I walked up and I found a secretary, and there wasn't really a lot of people on campus at the time. And I just said, can anyone point me to a way that I can do an internship at the legislature? And I remember the secretary said, go to Dr. Murray's office. It's down the hall. So I walked down the hall, knocked on your door. You were in your office, and you said, who are you? What can I do for you?
I'm so welcoming.
And I said, hi, my name is Adam. I would really love to do an internship at the state legislature. And you go, okay, tell me about yourself. And so I did. And it was a very, very short resume. And you said, okay, great, we'll be in touch. And I got to do it.
Yeah.
You picked me.
That's
kind of how it started. Was my very first semester in college was an internship at the legislature.
Oh, that is very cool. Although now I look back at that and I think I should have made you take classes before I sent you to the legislature.
You totally should have. This is my entire life is your fault.
My memory, Adam, like I just remember, didn't you sit in that one classroom like you were over here?
Yes.
Right. I remember right where you sat. I always tell students, like, I will remember where students sit like forever and the energy that they have in a classroom. But yeah, like, so how do I say? It's the end of the semester. I feel like students hate faculty the most at this moment. But to a certain extent, I didn't hurt you.
No. Oh, my gosh. No.
There was no harm done.
You know, I had some great professors at Weber State. Yeah. And there's some whose classes I did not do well in. And Dr. Fudge. but I loved his class and I loved your class. The thing that made your class so neat is I remember when I had it, I had done my internship at the legislature, and while there, a member of Congress, our member was Congressman Rob Bishop, and he came to speak to the legislature, and he saw me in the hall, and he said, "Hey, I remember you. How do I remember you?" And I said, "Oh, I was a Senate page in high school, and so I lived out in D.C. You remember?" He's like, "Yes, I remember. So what are you doing with your life?" And I said, "Well, I'm interning here. I would love to work for you one day." And he goes, "Great. Come out to D.C. next year and you can work in my office and see if you like it." I did that. I worked in his office for a semester through Weber State, lived out in Washington, D.C., and worked on Capitol Hill. It was an amazing experience for me. And then my very last day, the chief of staff came up to me and he said, "You did a great job this summer, and we want to offer you the job of campaign manager for Congressman Rob Bishop." And that's kind of how I got my a big start in campaigns. And so I really can trace it back to like knocking on your door and, "Hey, this is what I want to do." That was a tremendous impact for me.
Yeah.
And I still remember it. I saw you up at Capitol Hill during the session. We gave each other a big hug and talked
favorite.
For a long time and with President Mortensen.
And I have to tell you, I came back from that because like my memory of it, which might be wrong, because it was the end.
It was like 11 o'clock
at
night.
Late at night. And all the lights were low. It felt like it was really dark. And all of you all were sitting out in the lobby waiting for like legislators to
lobbyists.
Come out. And
we hang
I was
out
like,
in lobbies.
I know. And I went back to my students. I'm like, "This is why we call it lobbying, because they sit in the lobby when they're doing this work." And I love, like, gosh, I need to have you come and talk to my students about why you do internships, right? Because what you just said is like, it's about the Rolodex.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's about running into Rob Bishop, these kind of serendipitous moments, but you got to kind of get in those places, right? To make those moments.
Out.
Right. Well, right. You got to be good, but you've got to also be in places where people have the opportunity to see you. Yeah. No, I love that. So I'm thinking, like, I just want to like talk about that a little bit because you're my student and I am so happy to be doing this with you. And I also love that on LinkedIn, people are like, "Now you get to argue with your former professor." I was like, "Yeah, this is going to be great." And I wanted to like talk about this with you, Adam, a little bit. Is there was an article today on KSL.com about Utah education reaching out to immigrants, right? And I thought it was really interesting because, let me just make sure I get this data right. They're saying like some 80% of people who live in Utah from abroad, right? So these are people who are here, you know, from other places on the planet. More than 80% of them have bachelor's degrees or hires. They also have an average of like 11 years professional work experience.
Which that is amazing. You never hear a stat like that.
I know. When we talk about this stuff, we don't talk about it. And so you're kind of like, we have a teaching labor shortage. I don't know how else to say that better, right? So we have teachers who are leaving. We've talked about that a lot on KSL. And now you're kind of like, maybe, how about we let people who have a bachelor's degree, have been educators in other countries, like that might be really cool. And so in this article, they're talking about allowing or figuring out how to help immigrants take their foreign credentials and make them Utah teaching licenses. Like, what do you think about that?
So we do this with a lot of other professions. So one thing that Utah is very known for is, you know, we don't like government intrusion.
Right.
And we change licensing to with different situations. And we had a problem a few years ago where military men and women are transferred to Hill Air Force Base or some other installation. And their spouse is a teacher. Their spouse is an electrician, something. And they get here and none of that transfers here. And so the legislature saw that as a big problem, which it was.
Yeah.
And so they made reciprocity for anyone serving in the military that is transferred here, that their spouse has reciprocity on their license. What a great idea.
Yeah. So reciprocity just basically means if you are a licensed teacher in Nevada, we're going to just acknowledge whatever that license says. Okay.
And it's really cool that we're exploring some of that with really smart people that have moved to the state of Utah that have dual language experience that can be teaching our kids.
Right.
So they meet all the requirements. Why not look into this? If you're qualified, you're qualified.
Do you think it takes legislative action like you just talked about? Does that make sense? So, I guess I'm asking, you know, the legislature is trying to say, let's have reciprocity for military. Does the legislature have to make a move that says we have a teacher shortage? Or is it already, have they already done this? Does that make sense? Like,
They've done it. I don't know about teaching specifically, but I know like Speaker of the House, Mike Schultz, and other leaders have really gone into the weeds on licensing to see what the requirements are and what the Department of Commerce can do on their own versus what needs to be fixed with legislative action. And so I know that if it can be fixed just by DOPL, which is under Department of Commerce, they handle professional licensing. They could fix it on their own. They will.
Yeah.
And if they can't, the legislature, I'm sure, is more than willing to work with the Cox administration to get something like this fixed.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a win-win-win-win-win.
It sounds
right?
like it.
Like, we need the teachers. These are people who have cool life experience, right? Like, I think it's fun for them to be able to talk about, like, if you were a teacher, talking about your lived experience, like the things that you've done, is a value add in the classroom, right? So people coming from other countries, it's probably...
Venezuela has gone through a crazy amount of turmoil. And to have a teacher who's like qualified, speaks Spanish, speaks English, who worked there and is now in Utah and could add that life experience here for my kids.
Awesome. That's
very neat.
All right. So thank you so much for listening to KSL at Night. If you are listening, you missed part of the show. Don't forget, you can check out our podcast on KSLpodcast.com. Just look up KSL at Night and we'll see you tomorrow night, 7 or 9 p.m.